Right, good evening. Good evening and welcome to the London School of Economics. My name is Ricky Burdett, and together with Philip Rothe and others from LSE Cities, I'm delighted to welcome so many of you here to celebrate the launch, the London launch, of a book called Shaping Cities in an Urban Age, which I'll come and talk about in a moment. This is, in fact, the third in a series of books which have been documenting a series of events and exchanges over the last 15-plus years. What is exciting about tonight is not only that it's a launch of a book with many of the authors, in fact, here together, but it's also part of an event at the LSE, which is a research festival, which, in fact, comes to its full fruition in 2019, which is called New World Disorder Series. So it's part of that discussion. But also the second exciting thing is that this is part of the third year of an executive master's in cities, which we've now run together with Savas Verdis, myself, Tony Travers, and Philip Rothe, which brings experts from around the world, many, many cities from different disciplines, and they're all here as part of a week of intense training and teaching. So it's a combination of London, the LSE, and the world coming together to talk about cities. The format of the evening, for many of you who are familiar with it, let me just remind you, is that there will be a number of presentations here from the floor, from the desk, in some cases showing slides. All four of the speakers, myself included, will then sit at the panel, sit at the front and have a panel discussion, and in the last part of the evening, ending at 8 o'clock, we will have a Q&A from the floor. Again, there will be stewards with roving mics coming round when it comes to the Q&A. If you feel like it, it would be great if you stand up, only because we can then see you. It's actually quite disconcerting to hear a voice. I'm not sure where it's from. But if you want to, it's fine. But please tell us who you are. And then the third LSE rule is ask a question. Don't make a long statement. That's a standard here. Very well known. I'll come at the end to make a number of thanks, but I do want to start by thanking the Alfred Herrhausen Gesellschaft, the AHG, which has supported not only this book, but everything we've been doing at LSE Cities and in at the Urban Age for the last 17 years, in fact. It's been a long and fruitful collaboration. The evening, as I say, will have, after my brief introduction, three of the 37 authors who have contributed to this publication over here. It weighs a bit less than the previous two, and there will be a book signing outside if you want to purchase them. I'm not sure whether it's at a discount, but it's very, very good value. Think most academic books of 80 pages cost something like £100. This costs much less than that. And it's 400-plus pages. And I do want to thank Fiden, the publishers, for the third time working intensely with us. Robin Taylor is here for making such a beautiful publication of academic quality. The three speakers are, therefore, three of our colleagues who've contributed to the Urban Age project over the last years. And I'll document their background in a moment. But some will be very familiar to you, and others have traveled from far to join us for this event. The first will be Nick Stern, who's a professor of economics here and well known to many of you as Lord Stern of climate change, as the individual who really put the economics of climate change on the map. In 2006 was the author, of course, with many others, of the Stern Report, which has been strongly influential in putting climate change on the political map all round, and we've been fortunate with Philip to work together on collaborating, putting cities on the climate change map together, which is what he will be talking about. From Rio de Janeiro, a city where we hosted one of our Urban Age events a number of years back, we have Eduarda Larocque. Eduarda was, at that point, while we were all working together, the chief finance minister, effectively, of that city for a number of years, responsible for many of the positive things. But as you'll hear later, and this is rare for a person who's been in power or effectively is in power, to be very open about some of the difficulties that actually making political promises and then realizing them cities, what it actually means, having worked on a city like Rio de Janeiro with all its complexities. And then we have Saskia Sassen, well-known and colleague and friend, one of the founders with Richard Sennett of the whole Urban Age project a number of years ago, whose work on understanding global cities, understanding the processes and flows between cities of monies, capital, of money, people, ideas, and more recently the whole notion of the extraction and expulsion of goods and resources is very much part of her work. In her recent book on expulsions, and she'll be talking about her chapter in this publication on questions of ownership of the city. So we have three different angles. We have issues of climate change, the urgency of dealing with climate change in cities. We have issues of ownership and interest, and we have issues of governance as part of the presentations that we'll hear in a second. But I want to start, if I may, by going to the first slide, just to show you a little bit what is in the book and what are the contents of it. As I say, it's the outcome of the last 6 or 7 years of the Urban Age, a series of conferences and discussions jointly organized by these two organizations that you see here. We've held conferences or done studies in the yellow dots that you see there. In fact, we've had 16, 17 conferences. The next one will be in Addis Ababa later this year. But many of the other cities that you see featured on that global map are areas where we've done work, which basically is around, and this is simplifying our work enormously, linking spatial issues to social issues at the heart of the urban agenda. We've held conferences. This was in London in 2012. More recently in Venice, where we in fact had a similar event only last Saturday. And as I say, this is the third, slightly less heavy, but nonetheless very significant book that represents the research and the contributions from many of the scholars and practitioners who've been part of it. The first two, The Endless City and Living in the Endless City, were co-edited by Dan Sujic and myself. This third book is co-edited by Philip Rode and myself. Urbanization, it's easy to talk about cities as if they were the same thing. If you just take a look at this one map, in yellow, wherever you are in the room, you don't need to see the details, you see where the United Nations tells us there will be greater concentration of urban growth in the next 10, 15 years. Pretty soon. And you see that there's an unequal distribution across the geography of the world. In green, by the way, it's more or less where cities have grown in my lifetime since the Second World War, and in the lighter green in the last decades of the 20th century. But it's the areas in Asia, in India, in Africa, which have most concentration of yellow, and these today are relatively poor and relatively low energy parts of the world. So the questions are very clear to the three speakers and to the authors of this book. How do we deal with dramatic pace of change and urbanization and deal with these issues? You can't see the exact details of what is on this matrix, but the fastest growing cities on the world, if you take the top 4 or 5, I'll read them out, are Dar es Salaam, Luanda, Lagos, Addis Ababa, Kinshasa. You have to go down quite a bit to get to Chinese cities and slip all the way down in this list to hit the classic ones that we all expect to be growing very fast, like Mexico City and others. Many of these cities are large, are growing, but have slowed down. So we need to understand that there's a shift, as you can see from these statistics, of more people, 2.5 billion more people, let me stress, moving into cities by 2050. This is increase in natural birth rate and people moving to cities. It's both. It's not just immigration. And nearly 90% of that will be happening in Asia or Africa. You saw that on the map. And the key point here, which links, I know, to one of the key aspects that Nick wants to talk about, is that much of the infrastructure, in the wider sense of the word, has to actually be built in the next decades, but that will affect people and generations of urban dwellers to come. So the future of the world's urban population will be built in our lifetime, and particularly looking at all the students from the LSE and elsewhere, certainly in your lifetime, and it's your responsibility. So in this book, we're interested in change. And we've had the benefit, because of this project has been around for a bit, to actually look back over the last 25 years. And we've looked at cities like Guangzhou in China, which if you see on the map on the left, in the darker blue, is what it used to be only 25 years ago. And the lighter blue is where it is now. So issues of sprawl. Let me just look at two statistics. The population has grown nearly 1,000%. Nearly 1,000%. That's a big number. But its girth, its sprawl, is over 3,000, nearly 3,300%. So those are the sort of statistics and issues and the need for data in an objective way, which is really at the heart of the Urban Age project. Meanwhile, Singapore, by design, and I'm not promoting this as the best model of all, but there's a lot to say about Singapore, has grown, but its footprint has actually remained really quite tight and narrow in order to keep the infrastructure and the density high. This is what we're facing in terms of uncontrolled growth. Call it sprawl, call it favelas, call it informal development. We don't want to use pejorative terms. This is what is happening out there. And this image of Kinshasa actually shows, if we took this picture now, it was taken about 6 or 9 months ago, the green bit on the right would be filled by now. So that's the issue that we're describing. But it's not all negative. Addis Ababa, one of many cities, is actually trying very hard to invest in transport and in 250,000 homes. Sadiq Khan, listen. Right? They built 250,000 homes in about 3 years. You know, so these are things that we need to understand. So questions of growth are represented by a city like Shanghai, and we've tried to track this in much of the documentation in the book. What this shows is an image of density as it was about 25 years ago and as it's become. The lower the spike, the less number of people in the space, in the city. Imagine this room with half the population, it would be on the left, and that's Shanghai as it's changed on the right. So what we've realized, and what is in the book, is that you can't talk about the cities in a simplistic way. We've divided it up in a number of themes and chapters, and I say there are 37 authors. And I'm delighted. A lot of them are in the room here. If they're not in the room, they're here certainly mentally and emotionally. Richard Sennett is in Paris and can't be here, but otherwise would have been a participant. Let me mention, in fact, that one of our co-travelers, Sophie Baudy-Gendreau, who might have been here, unfortunately passed away last week, and we want to remember her. The book has an enormous amount of data, but also a lot of understanding of what these different processes are. I don't expect you to look at this now, but importantly, there's a sort of comparative analysis of those elements which are important to growth from now and in the future. If we just take one example, one theme, which I know Eduarda will want to talk about, inequality. This image has become a sort of poster child of inequality. Right, slightly, it's nearly too obvious, but it's real. And when we showed it at the Venice Biennale a number of years ago, people thought it was literally a Photoshop of a favela without much water on one side and towers on the right side, apartment blocks with swimming pools. The issue here is not whether there's rich or poor. Every city will always have that. There will always be inequality. The issue is the wall in the middle. And that's something we're very interested in trying to understand in connecting space and society. And we've tracked issues of inequality. You see inequality maps here in Rio, in London, Hong Kong. The darker the color, the more unequal it is. You will recognize parts of London in this image, as you, Eduardo, will recognize that the outskirts, the periphery of Rio is very, very segregated, as is part of Hong Kong. So in the book, we also track where people are living and what sort of designs are actually made. This is some of the responses. This is a new town, a private town in China. This is Hong Kong, very efficient in terms of land use, but interesting how even that physical environment has been able to sustain, should we say, a degree of informality amongst the domestic workers who are there. So a key theme of the book is what Richard talks about, Richard Sennett, the open city, that we need to always repair and deal with cities and do something with them. We can't leave them as they are, as a fixed element. So issues of constraints are fundamental. These statistics are extraordinary if you look at it. That the USA, the whole of the United States, used this number of gigatons, it's an enormous number, of cement in a century. And look at the number that has been used in China in a few years. You know, those are the sort of issues. This is what's being built, and Nick will talk about how planning, such as what is happening, say, in Lagos, it could be elsewhere, will fix us in, lock us in to models which will undoubtedly have negative impacts for generations to come on pollution and climate change. Power is another fundamental aspect that we're all going to be talking about, and certainly Eduarda and Saskia. You know, having a mayor is not a given. We only invented having an executive elected mayor here in the year 2000. It's a new thing. But, you know, that doesn't solve all the problems. So issues of whose voice is represented in Rio, in other parts of the African world, and how power is actually distributed is discussed at length in the essay. Saskia very much will talk about the fact that power can also be used through money, through finance, so that there are capital projects such as Hudson Yards in the States or parts of Beijing, which are actually owned and invested in by very, very few major corporate structures. But turning immediately to the issues that are going to come to hand with Nick, you know, certain things were not clear when we started this project. So this notion of dealing with uncertainty is fundamental. Did we know that a third of New York would black out? But then that creates an opportunity actually for new ideas of what could happen to the waterfront. Did we know 6-7 years that we would have to be dealing in European cities with the refugee crisis that we're all witnessing? So that's so that even in Berlin, you have a beautifully organized, elegantly made refugee center in Tempelhof, which was debated for so many decades, or years anyway, in terms of what might actually happen to it. So cities need to be resilient, and this is where I want to end. Intervention, doing things to cities to fix them, is absolutely essential. The problem is that when you made a landscape like this one, it's very difficult to fix it. It's very difficult to actually work with it, like a metabolism of a human body. But there are examples. In Seoul, how do you cross a 5-lane motorway? Well, you can be inventive. This is Vinnie Mass and MVRD doing a garden, effectively cutting across the city. And I end with this image of a workers' club. It's called SESC in São Paulo by one of the great architects, modernist architects of the era. And what it is a building, it's effectively a workers' club where people who work in the retail industry for a subsidized amount can do a number of things, including use this swimming pool at the top of one of the toughest parts of the city itself. It's already changing the degree of integration and accessibility of the city. So architecture, design, and many things do make a difference. But ultimately, we need to understand, and this is at the heart and the key message of the book, that cities and urbanization is not a fixed thing. It's an open process that is changing all the time. It's iterative, and it's incomplete, and we have to learn how to deal with that changing machine. So I'm going to stop there and then ask Nick Stern to come up and deal with the issues from his perspective. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ricky. It's a real pleasure to be here for the launch of the book. LSE Cities is a jewel in the crown of LSE, and I've been very happy to be associated with it from the very, very early stages. I mean, cities are more than half of our people. They're something like three-quarters of the output and something like three-quarters of the greenhouse gas emissions. If we're talking about the world, we're mostly talking about cities. And if we're talking about the future of the world, that statement becomes still stronger. The paper or the section of the book I'm talking about was written jointly with the wonderful Dimitri Zengelis, who can't be here tonight, but I wanted to emphasize it was very much joint with him, and he's been a splendid bridge between economics and cities, climate change and cities, at the London School of Economics. Now, I've got five, sounds like the beginning of a sort of Cartesian French approach, j'ai cinq points, But I've got 5 points here. Three are about the nature of the problem and two about the nature of the response to the problem. So the first is that this is a unique and defining two decades for cities, and it's a unique and defining two decades for climate. And obviously, given what I've just said, those two statements are intimately related. Let's start with the cities. I'm going to refer to the images in large measure that Ricky has put up, but I won't be offering you any slides. We all do it our own way. Right? So this is I'm going to use the English language, and you can look at me. The population of urban areas will double in the next 40-some years. It doesn't matter for this argument whether it's 40 or 45 or 38 or whatever. The population will double, and the area will probably double in two decades or thereabouts. That is a very intense problem. That is sprawl, big time. So can we, will we be able to manage that? And of course, if the area doubles in the next two decades or so, on the way to the population doubling in the next 40 years or so, the decisions we take now in the next 2, 3, 4, 5 years, given the long lags in the kind of infrastructure we're talking about, shape what happens to cities over the rest of this century. It's that urgent. On climate, the world's infrastructure will probably double in about 15 years. In the next 15 years or so, we'll have a new lot of infrastructure roughly equal in size to the one we have. The biggest expansion will be in urban areas in Asia, but it will be much more than that. The world economy at a growth rate of 3.1-3.2%, which is not far off what we might expect, will double in 20 years. Again, it doesn't matter for this argument whether it's 18 or 25, but roughly speaking, at those kinds of growth rates, it doubles in two decades. This is a two decades where, if we want to manage climate change along the lines of the Paris Agreement, well below 2 degrees, we have to cut emissions absolutely by 25 or 30%, depending on the kind of probability we're looking for achieving that target. So we're doubling infrastructure in 15, doubling the world economy in 20 years, and that's a period when we've got to cut emissions absolutely, not as a fraction of output, absolutely, by 25, 30%. So you can see this next two decades is defining for the climate. We have to do things. Shall I try again? We have to do things clearly very differently. Now you've made me jumpy. Yeah? Okay. Since I've been speaking about doubling, I suppose echoes are quite... anyway, that's those two senses, fundamentally interrelated, of course, but those two senses in which this is a defining 20 years, in large measure shaped by the decisions we take in the next few years, is absolutely fundamental. The second, related to the first, but it's the lock-in that Ricky referred to. It's not simply about hesitating, delaying, and getting to some goal a bit later than we would have liked. I mean, cutting world poverty of fundamental importance is where I've spent most of my academic life over the last 4.5 or 5 decades. But if we cut poverty later, it's a shame. Shame on us. But it hasn't necessarily made it impossible. Now, this is not like that. If we delay and dither for the next 20 years, we will have locked in infrastructure, which is polluting, congested, dirty, and it will be very hard to unlock from there. You can't just go suddenly from high carbon to low carbon. You can't go suddenly from very congested cities to much less congested cities. You lock in the way it functions, and that's a very important element in this story. So we lock in the pollution, particularly the greenhouse gas emissions, and we lock in the inefficiency and congestion of badly handled infrastructure. And remember, and this is a third kind of lock-in, that the flows of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere go into concentrations. It's a ratchet effect, and it's the concentrations of greenhouse gases that prevent the infrared from leaving and cause the global warming through the exactly that. Ultraviolet comes in, bounces off the Earth's surfaces, comes back at infrared, and the oscillation frequency of the greenhouse gases interfere, and you're trapping the heat there. And what's going on, of course, is that higher the concentrations of greenhouse gases, the more the global warming. And if you're going to stabilize the temperature, at whatever it might be, if you're going to stabilize the temperature, you have to stabilize the concentrations. So what you've got there is a ratchet effect. The later you leave it, the more emissions you've put out, and the higher the concentrations. And as it were, if you then start to get moving, you've given yourself a much harder problem because the concentrations are already higher. So there's three forms of lock-in there. There's the lock-in of the emissions and pollution. There's the lock-in of the physical layout and the congestion. And there's a lock-in associated with the ratchet effect. So it's not just that these problems are around the decisions of the next 20 years. If we don't take those decisions, we're in deep trouble from the lock-in. Now, the third point I wanted to make, and really Ricky has made it, but if you look at what it is about cities then that we're going to have to change and do much better, so that they can deliver the great places that they can be to live in. The first point is the sprawl, and the second point is the nature of the transport infrastructure. There's much more, of course, there's the buildings and so on, but the two biggest points, in my view, is the sprawl, and you saw it from Ricky's descriptions, and the strength and functionality of the transport system. At this point, I usually check, is there anybody here from Atlanta? Good. So the next question is, would you like to live in Atlanta or Barcelona? Barcelona, I hear you cry. And roughly speaking, the population and the income per capita are similar in those two cities. One works really rather well, and you couldn't say that about the other. That is an indication of what the kind of thing we're looking for is. What is the prize? It's living in a very nice place, attractive place to live. That's what we get if we get this right. That's, as it were, the sprawl story, and Ricky illustrated. Secondly, we have to recognize on the transport side now that the era of being able to take your private car wherever you like, whenever you like, is over. It doesn't work. Yeah? Nothing anti this or anti that. It simply doesn't work. And that's what we have to now recognize. 40 years ago, people said, this is the era of the private car, and you build roads everywhere to take it into your city centers, and you build lots of parking, and you can't have a building without parking. Well, now we see is that you shouldn't have a building with parking. That's a problem. And what we can now see is how to make transport very different. The barriers between public and private are being blurred. There's all sorts of sharing. There's self-driven cars. There's bikes and walking and all these things, which are so important. We can see how to do it differently. But making that happen, of course, is an enormous challenge. Now, those are the challenges, starting to talk about where we need to go. But let me now, very briefly, and we've published on this elsewhere, of course, The different route is actually the growth story of the 21st century. It's enormously attractive. It's full of creativity, discovery, information. Creativity, discovery, innovation, investment, growth. That's the different story. The cities, and it's full of creativity, of course. Now, the cities are at the heart of that story. We live in cities because it's so much more efficient and creative to work together and interact with each other. That's the heart of the dynamism and the creativity. And it's all about, I've already given that description, really. In large measure, it's about sustainable infrastructure. And we've made enormous progress in the last dozen or so years. Who would have thought, you mentioned the Stern Review. When we published the Stern Review, who would have thought that a solar panel would cost less than one-tenth of what it cost at that time? Who would have thought now renewable energy with storage costs less, even without a carbon price, than conventional fossil fuel energies in many, not everywhere, but in many parts of the world. And that's going on downwards. It's not just many parts of the world. It will be nearly all parts of the world before too long. Amazing progress. Who would have thought that the heads of the major car companies would be saying, not just Elon Musk or cuddly Volvo, but Ford and General Motors, all be saying that the era of the internal combustion engine is coming to an end. We hadn't heard of Uber a dozen years ago. This is a quite extraordinary change in this last century about what we can do. That's why we call it the growth story of the 21st century, and it's in our hands. It's actually feasible. It's also much more inclusive. Public transport, which will be a big part of this, taking into account that the barriers between public and private will be blurred. Public transport benefits poor people particularly because normally they have to travel further to work. Getting rid of the pollution and the PM2.5s and the nitrates and so on also benefits poor people much more than which because they're actually riding around and walking and being in places where they're much more vulnerable to that kind of pollution. This is a very inclusive story, as well as being a sustainable story. So we can now see it in ways which we couldn't, I think, a dozen or so years ago. That's the big optimistic part of the story. And we can see how that growth story is driven. It's not simply anymore that the costs of inaction are much bigger than the costs of action. That statement, which we made a dozen years or so ago, is even stronger now. But it's a much more dynamic story than that. It's about this is the alternative way to grow, and it's incredibly attractive. Not growth forever. Forever's a long time. We're talking about the next 20, 30 years, which are what we're focusing on here. What policies? I have to be very brief because I'm out of time. But it's about city design. It's about what shapes sustainable infrastructure. It's about research and development and innovation. It's about development banks, which will be very important because the capital markets don't work well enough for the kinds of change which I've described. It's about regulation and standards and management. It's about carbon pricing. And it's about the public finance and the powers of cities, which are very important in centre-city relationships. Just take public finance. One of the reasons why cities expanded so fast in China, and not just China, is that the public finances were dependent on selling marginal land. So you sell the land on the edge, and that's where you get your money. Well, if you had a much stronger public finance system around the taxation of property and land, then you could do much better. So it's intimately related with the story of the public finances and the relationship between central powers and city powers. So that was the fifth point, a very fast sketch over the policies that we're going to need. Fourth point is this is the growth story, and I've tried to describe it. And fifth is the policies that could deliver. So basically, in conclusion, we know clearly how urgent it is. The simple numbers I gave at the beginning are overwhelmingly compelling in my view. We know it's urgent. We know now that it's enormously attractive and it's feasible to do things differently. We don't know everything. We know how to begin. That's the key. We know how to begin and we know we'll learn like mad along the way. We know enough to take these decisions over the next 4 or 5 years that we have to take. So the question is, will we? And that's a matter of political will. Well, political will starts with the understanding of why you're doing it, it's very attractive, and how you're doing it. That's what we're talking about today. But to translate that into action, of course, what I've described is a necessary condition. It's not a sufficient condition. But one of our jobs in the academic world is to show, define the problem, show how we can respond, show it's feasible, and show it's attractive. And that's what we've tried to do in this book. Thank you very much.
Yeah, there's no sound. It's not working here. Brazilian, it's not Brazilian. Please. We should begin again. It's just to show a little bit of our reality in the slums, in Rio, and to show how Rio is a split city between slums and formal cities. And so if you could... The music is very good, so I prepare a fun thing for you.
Then why don't we go to the slides and...
And then come back, so yeah. So this is a video that shows Rio's pact.
Let's try and do this.
Too much.
Yeah. So let's just go. Okay. Start here and then we'll show the video later when we fix the sound.
Okay. So the video is about Rio's Pact. That was my last attempt to confront inequality and promote urban, social, and economic development of our slums. So I take part in Rio, the rise, and it's not by coincidence that the cover of the magazine, The Economist, is the Christ, that is one of the most emblematic symbols of Rio de Janeiro, goings or up, taking off, and then Brazil blown it. So I took part in this whole history, first as the Secretary of Finance, and then trying to promote the development of our slums. So I was very concerned. I have worked for 7 years for the City Hall of Rio de Janeiro, and in the first beginning, for the 3 hours and a half, we were very successful. I will show some numbers, but we could have 3 upgrades from the credit agents. We got our investment grade. We doubled our budget. But then I was very concerned about inequality. I have perceived that the Olympic Party was not for everybody. And this would be a huge problem, as it were. And now, unfortunately, we are on the cover. Brazil is on the cover of The Economist again. But it's not part of my talk, so let's go on. We have done many things. We have promoted a huge revitalization of the seaport area. It was an $8 billion public-private partnership, but it's not that private because it's 100% financed by the Labor Pension Fund. So we did a lot of efforts and improvements in the transport area. So these are the 4 Olympic hubs. And the lines were the existing transport before the Olympic Games. And by investing a lot, we could connect all the 4 Olympic hubs. So it was a huge improvement in terms of mobility and social results. But we couldn't approach inequality. So due to governance problems, in particular the lack of transparent cooperation within the public sector and across sectors, with civil society and private companies, and that's what the video talks a little bit about, the investments associated with these mega events have not made a significant impact on inequality. And the graph shows that Brazil is one of the most unequal countries in the world. So our poor people are as poor as the Indians, the Africans, and our rich people who will vote for him, not him, are as rich as Americans and British and this stuff. So we have to confront inequality. Well, we have to talk about security. So one of the major plans of the state government, and then we have to distinguish the responsibilities of the municipal and the state government, and security is under responsibility of the state government, they implementing this pacifying policy units, UPPs, is a way of pacify, how to pacify. We have to complement the pacification, the police guys, with social improvements. And this was under the responsibility of the city hall. And then in 2012, after the first term of Eduardo Paes, our mayor, I changed from the Secretary of Finance to take care of IPP, that is the research department of the city hall, and there I found out that information and research departments are the jewel of the crown. Information for transformation. This is very important, one of the main points of my talk. So this pacification was very extensive. So thank you, Rick. It's one of the figures of the book. So it's obvious it would obviously not work, right? But it did work for a while. So the homicide rates had decreased a lot for a while, a lot, half the indicator, but now is increasing again. In my specialty, I used to be a financial woman, and we could double in 4 years our budget, our expenditures, and we could multiply for more than 10 our investment capacity. But the point is, what are we looking for? So I was considered the best finance secretary ever, because we could achieve investment ratio of 20%. But did it work? What should we target? We should target a sustainable development process. So we have to think about something like an asset liability management for urban management. So we have to think in the long run and not anticipating all the revenues in order to increase investments and not having resources enough to keep the growth. So, and then we see in 2016, the last year of Mayor Eduardo Paes, we had 28 billions of expenditure and revenues, and then now the new mayor, that is Crivella, the revenues could, the revenues are decreasing a lot, and the investments are nothing again. So, go the rise and the fall. We have to think about sustainable development models. So, the most important lesson to be learned from the rise and fall of Rio is that an independent entity with substantial citizen participation must be in charge of information management if sustainable development goals are to be achieved. So that's what we have discussed during this morning. So, and we don't cannot focus only on fiscal numbers in economics aspects. We have to have a broader view considering economics, environmental, social, so we have Nick, we have Saskia, economics, and governance is very important, is the most important thing from my point of view, but we have also culture, urban, so, and in the center you have human capital. So it's a model of seven types of capitals, and that we can put all the SDGs around all this capital that we are trying to improve. And I do believe that we can, in the world, not in terms of public management, expand the concept of return to cover not only financial return, but also social and environmental return. So I used to work with finance, with a matrix of risk, and we can put everything together and try to establish goals and in a public private partnership with the civil society, we can establish long-run targets and monitor them. So the importance of research departments and institutions like LSC are very important to take this in account. So the summary of my presentation is here. It was a great pleasure to take part of this book. And so I believe that the best way of confronting inequality is through spatial territorial development. That's what I have tried to do. And if it's possible to show the video, we can go through it. And so just to finish, the implementation of data-driven public policy evaluation system is crucial to involve citizens in public policy making and monitoring. That's it.
Well, I would really like to start, and I didn't alert you, Ricky, of this, by... I'm innocent, whatever. All right. Right.
You?
Oh, we don't have a blank. I needed a blank before this. There's no blank?
There.
Okay, very good. So, I really want to thank Ricky Burdett and the whole team that across... Well, how long has it been, 20 years?
2005.
Oh, not 20 years then, a bit less. But it's been an amazing task, and when you look at the three volumes, they're absolutely extraordinary. So can I ask us all to give them a big round of applause? Really. So now to less pretty things. I have been doing some work in several cities about the fact that there is a lot of buying of urban properties and a strange kind of development that involves algorithmic math that I want to sort of share with you a bit. So the first image that I would like to put in the air is the notion that a city, a real city, a working city, is a complex but incomplete system. Now, in that mixture of complexity and incompleteness lies also the capacity of cities to have outlived far more powerful but closed systems of power. So think of the age of some of our cities. I mean, centuries and centuries. And there they are. And what has survived histories of all sorts is especially sort of the complexity of the city. On the one hand, very often, historically speaking, the rich neighborhoods and the poor neighborhoods. And I'm, of course, particularly appreciative that the poor neighborhoods have also survived these kinds of, totally different epochs. Now, there is a lot of positive stuff to be said about cities. I want to focus right here on some negatives, emergent negatives. And it has to do with a switch, an economic switch, that involves algorithmic mathematics. And with algorithmic mathematics, it's quite amazing what you can do. The algorithm is an open system. So you can utilize it, deploy it, develop it, etc., in many different ways. I want to focus on one particular issue, which is the use of algorithmic mathematics to transform what we see as a building through a series of very complex steps into something that is no longer a building. The building stands there, but the action happens in the zone of algorithmic mathematics. And I'll show you some information about this. Now, there are many impressive things about that capability. You understand that you're looking at a building, you see the building is a building. Nope. The action is actually like 17 steps later on something that has to do with algorithmic mathematics, with high finance, etc., etc. Now, I'm going to start with a first sort of element. This was the famous subprime mortgage, which produced 14.5 million households, not people, households, that went bankrupt. And so here are some of those elements. So the making of instruments that enable the use of modest elements and assets to build a powerful financial instrument that is useful to top-level investors, and the name that we have given it is the subprime mortgage, you know, for low-income people. Now, what happened here? So first I want to show you the numbers involved. These numbers are amazing. Some of these are repetitive, you know, this is. But in a period of about 7 to 10 years, and mostly most of this happened within the 7-year period, 14.5 million households went broke. They had been sold something that was described as a mortgage. There was a deployment, it was like an army deploying, neighborhood after neighborhood after neighborhood. And it was really addressed to modest income people because those were the only ones who didn't own a house at that point in the United States. 14.5 million contracts, that's a lot. 14.5 million contracts represent many more people, like 30 million people. I'm Dutch. That's twice the population of the Netherlands. 30 million people. Now, in a very short, brutal history, from signing that contract to going broke was a catastrophic event. Now, what actually happened there? Let's see, I can't remember what my next slide is here. Okay, so I can't walk here, can I? Do I have a mic? No, I can't walk, okay. So I'd like to sort of point out a bit. So this instrument, there are many versions of it, but one of the versions that I have really studied, it's like, oh, thank you. I can walk. It involves very, you know, very complex forms of knowledge that are admirable. So when you walk into Goldman Sachs, famous financial firm, and a colleague of mine enabled me to understand some of the stuff that was happening, he works there, etc., you see where the secretaries used to sit, like 100 secretaries, the back room, Now it's 100 physicists. So what has happened, and this was the first experiment, and it actually worked rather well for a lot of people who did not sort of wait till the crisis happened, because there was a crisis. What happened was, by algorithmic mathematics, you can actually transform, as I was saying, this building, this materiality, into something that is an instrument, an algorithmic. Yeah? We saw the buildings. We saw the poor people losing their homes. What we didn't see, really, was that a lot of wealth was concentrated and made off that until the crisis hit. That was time one. And we might almost say that it was like the experiment. Then came time two. This is a list, here only 10, of 100 cities in the world that are the objects of desire of investors. The figures that are shown here, and this is sort of a high point, we just got the data for 2016, 2017. So look at New York, those 55 billion, that is just the buying of existing property. 1 year. Not, you know, so year after year. And so you see, for instance, you know, all sort of a mix of cities. Again, there are 100 here. So just to notice that, you know, this is like 1 year, one set of amounts, and again, just the buying of existing property. And here you have a bigger distribution, et cetera, et cetera. You see, it's an extraordinary mixture of cities. Now, then comes time two. Oh, no, I'm sorry. This is just foreign buyers. So London is the queen of the domain. And something like, you know, the Qatari royals own more of central London than the Queen of England, which I actually find positively sympathetic, but that's another matter. Now, I want to point out, so London and New York have been objects of desire for a while. Shenzhen is new, so the rate of growth is much higher. So this is a roving machine that, once it's done with a few core elements, it moves on. And here you have, again, that distribution. You can see that there are certain cities that are really totally dominant at the top, etc. But look at the mixture also of cities. Now, and here an element just to illustrate, Berlin. 2015, Berlin, 11 trillion. That minus is a decline from the prior year. But then the roving animal, so Frankfurt higher, first Berlin, then Frankfurt, then München, and now it's Hamburg. They're sort of less in, I mean, still investing, but much less. So you can see that it is select, it takes a few properties, and it sort of moves on. Oh, and there is Nanjing. Nanjing, for instance, is much higher right now, Nanjing in China, than Shanghai or Beijing, because they have done that. So it's very limited number of properties. Now, here's an issue. The material. What does the material actually tell us? As I said, those buildings were buildings, very material, and then they become an algorithmic instrument. Look at this. Central London. I rarely go here, frankly. But I was asked to go and walk here because I had been talking about it, and so a smart journalist said, okay, let's go walk where you are always talking about. You see all of these properties? Very nice looking. I don't particularly like this one, but there it is. And so I heard the tourists around there saying, look at all these beautiful British properties. They're all owned by one Chinese company. Now, I have nothing against China or Chinese companies that own all these buildings. That's not the point. The point is that the material tells us less than it used to. You know, indeed, there was a time when the tourists were right. These were all British properties. Now they are not. I mean, this is a select number, right? There are many more buildings there. So something about the material that is no longer telling us sort of the full story. By the way, I mentioned the Chinese. I just want to show that they are the major investors in the world. You know that the Development Bank of China is bigger than our sort of Western famous development bank. So it is not to hit on the Chinese. It is just that they are very, very active. We know that, right? Now, the top 100 cities that I've been looking at by property, 10% of the world's population, 30% of the world's GDP, 76% of property investment. This term here, investment, is wrong. This is not investment. This is something else. It is sort of, you know, it's a construction, intermediated, etc. To call it investment is too simple, but that's the term that is often used. Now, according to Savills, the total of all the properties, I just looked at the top 100, but all the properties that are being subjected to this kind of treatment, where via algorithmic mathematics, you transform what is the rigidity of a building into actually a financial instrument that you can buy, sell in one day, and, you know, several times probably. The total, so this is not all the properties in the world. All the properties in the world is a huge number. It's just a select 217 trillion. That is far more than the global GDP of all the countries in the world. That is, moreover, not really money. That is something else. That is partly this issue of algorithmic mathematics and what it allows you to do, and it is partly some other set of innovations. A few other elements. This is 65,000 buildings in the Greater London area. All of them are owned by actors who lack a name. We don't know who they are. And they're all based outside the UK. Now, you know, this is not an issue of nationalism. This is an issue of the flexibilities, the multiple intermediate steps that can be developed to get to this. There is a lot of stuff that is invisible, even though we are dealing with very material conditions. And that, to me, is also sort of me, the intellectual, the theorist, is very intrigued by that. Manhattan. This is a bit different. We have built quite a few luxury towers. They're famous buildings, very expensive. Here's another one. You know, these are all very fancy buildings. This darkness means these are residential, that nobody has acquired them. The natural response is to say, oh my God, poor guys. Well, I don't know that we're a poor guy, but, you know, it failed. Not necessarily. Because these buildings, and this is happening, are beginning to function as assets via algorithmic mathematics. It's no longer a building. After all those complex steps, you have something very different. You have a pile of materialities that allow you to build an asset-backed security. The high investment circuit doesn't want derivatives. Derivatives are for us. You know, regularly, buyers of derivatives have gone broke. Like the most recent case, for instance, 14 municipal governments in Italy went broke at the same time. They thought they had made a loan. No, they had been sold a derivative. So the high investment circuit, for the last several years, has been saying, no derivatives, give me an asset-backed security. And I sort of conclude with this, repeating where I started. By algorithmic mathematics, you transform this building into something that is completely abstract, that is no longer the building. One image, a field of materialities. Those mortgages that I started with, those millions, 14.5 million mortgages that were told to these people, sign, sign, you can own a house, just sign. That had nothing to do with providing homes. That had to do with the high investment circuit saying, give me asset-backed securities. And so this is what this is. The building that we see is not the real thing. Now, I know that I have to conclude, but I'm going to skip this. This is the invention of a new housing market, which has minimum level. So, you know, what is it? 18 million, et cetera, et cetera. You know? So it's a certain kind of market. You say university medical centers often use this type of market too. They don't want to recruit people for their staff that are just anything. No, they want to go to particular universities. So particular universities relate to other particular universities. And this is a bit that way, only it's about housing. And these are the key buyers, as you see. Now, this is a very interesting market. This data come, I'm sorry, but I've been traveling too much and I'm losing my voice. Now, here is the issue. A city is full of materialities. We tend to think that, you know, a wall is a wall. I am actually seeing the real thing. I'm seeing a wall. These modalities, and they are expanding. Algorithmic mathematics is brilliant, brilliant stuff. And again, as I said, I don't hold the physicists accountable. But the material is telling us less and less. And that I find very interesting, besides all the other issues that are involved in this, which is a monopolizing via very, very sophisticated instruments of a fairly significant, you know, aspect of our cities and economies. Now, putting it all together, jumping through all kinds of things, I think this image, which is probably familiar to many of you, you know, these high-rise buildings, sort of a fairly rich middle class, poor, a lot of poor housing. In Europe, we don't see much of that, barely anything, I think. But in much of the world, that is the future. Now, if you put it all together, you say, you know, the whole housing question, which is huge, and then this notion that buildings, including housing, of course, can be sort of rerouted to a completely different logic so that they actually are, you know, they have nothing to do with housing. To me, this is very alarming. Second point, the fact that the material loses this capacity of speech. Now, I want to end with this image. This is a bit of a leap from where I started, but I just want to emphasize that, and this is, by the way, is by a photographer. There's no place in the world where you can stand and see this. I always am asked afterwards, oh, where can I see this? No. So he juxtaposes this, la periferia, this is real, and then sort of a mixture of buildings. In many ways, in many parts of the world, this is a bit, I would say, the urban future. So a juxtaposition of grand buildings, high-rise buildings, many of those buildings, moreover, can be empty because by algorithmic mathematics, you don't need to fill the building with actors, whether they're enterprises or homes, because that's not how you make your money. And then this juxtaposition. So to me, one of the great things about the urban age, the whole project, is that it has really moved us into a different level of understanding of the cities, a different level of analysis. Some very good things and some very dangerous things. Tonight here I focused on some dangerous things and, of course, some desperate conditions. Thank you very much.
What I think we should do is use these last 10, 15 minutes to go directly to questions from the floor so that we can wrap up roughly at the time that we said. We've had three incredibly rich and at one level diverse presentations, but that's what cities are exactly about. So I'm going to ask for three questions from the floor. Please wait for a microphone to come to you. Can I see any hands? There's a gentleman over there, gentleman over here, and a lady over there. So, Philip, if you take that microphone. First question.
Hi.
Do you mind standing up? Could you stand up? Thanks. So,
So my question is, I'm a little bit confused. Professor Stern, I think you mentioned the example of Barcelona as a very beautiful city. And then we have many examples of Rio, for example, nowadays, where the inequality is so high. And I know that, for example, the inequality in Brazil is not in no comparison to Europe right now. But all these great cities of Europe, like Barcelona or London, Paris, whatever, were built in times of extreme inequality. I just come from Stockholm, for example. The most beautiful parts of the city were basically buildings of old factory owners and so on. So we have these cities which are nowadays very high in standard of living, but now apparently, although we inequality is rising again, the cities which are built now are not so good anymore. And I'm a little bit confused there, because theoretically we knew already apparently how to build good livable cities, but now we don't do it anymore.
Thank you. Why don't we just, Nick and Eduardo, maybe touch upon that? Yeah.
What we're trying to argue here is that we can. And if you look at the system of public finances now compared to the system of public finances even a century ago, let alone a few centuries ago, the opportunities for doing things are really there. And if you look at the technologies that we now have for managing our cities, the opportunities are there. So I don't think we have to look back to the inequalities and those conditions for the creation of something that we want to put in place over the next 20 or 30 years. The challenges are to recognize what needs to be done. So in talking about Barcelona, we're recognizing the compactness of the city and we're recognizing the public places of the city. Now, the contrast with Atlanta is it's without the compactness and without the attractive public places. So those comparisons are to help identify what it is that we can create. And then we have to look at the public resources, and Eduarda rightly emphasized that I did too, but she in much more detail, the fundamental aspects of the public finances. We know the design and the technologies. We know the kind of incentive structures. We know how to create the development banks that can put these things together. So my argument was that we can look back at what we've got and draw the lessons about what we need to do, but then look forward to the financing and the technologies and so on to make it happen in the future, and we have to do that quickly.
Saskia, do you want to add to that? No, you're eating.
I was trying to make it invisible. No, I really appreciate what you just said, and I wish it were that way. I really think we're running into, besides all the challenges that a city entails, and sort of building for the modest populations, we know that is really a challenge. It's not easy given, you know. But I think that there is something else that is happening which we cannot overlook. And that is the again, via the development of extraordinarily admirable instruments. We're talking physicists, as I was saying, right? We are creating distortions, and this is happening in many cities. It's very partial, but it's happening. And I think we need to reckon with that, too, and we are not prepared. Municipal government simply...
But, Eduardo, isn't not that effectively your experience?
Yes.
Say more.
I think that we should focus on defining... What are the targets? So we have to define prosperity targets, and we have to combine with the population what we are trying to achieve, and then monitoring it. So I think that's the only way to confront inequality.
I know this gentleman.
So Philip Broder, Urban Age and LSE Cities. And a very brief reflection of, I think, what those of us that have been with this project from the beginning, a kind of cycle we've been through, and then a question for, I think, the entire panel. When we started the project, the Urban Age was so much about a celebration of city government and city-level decision-making. And there was a great belief that to an extent we can overcome the nation state. And I think we are now in a period where we realize that's not going to happen. We're actually deeply dependent on decision-making from higher tiers of government. So what we're now trying to do, and Nick, our Global Commission for the Economy and Climate is a good example, is we're trying to find a narrative about cities that resonates with national and supranational organizations and governments. How, in your experience, does language like the design of cities resonate with finance ministers? How does it resonate with people who actually have never been exposed to questions of architecture, urban form, and the infrastructures? Would be very interesting to hear, because I think all of you are exposed to those kind of national level politicians.
There are a few finance ministers in the room. We can go to them later. But
I think a sense of optimism about what we can do based on analysis and example is extremely important. Now, that doesn't mean that it's easy, but we have quite a lot of examples of rapid change to show that there are a lot of things that can be done. And really, Eduardo, you showed us examples of rapid change that you yourself had brought of managing well the public finances and using those to invest strongly. We've seen some of that in New York, which for a while changed very quickly with Bloomberg. So if we define a problem that's urgent, we must also be ready to provide examples where responses can be major and fast. And those examples exist. It doesn't pretend that it's easy, but if we throw up our hands and say it's all impossible, it will indeed be impossible. So I think that's really the key part of the story that you have to take to the finance minister. If the finance minister sees stories of success, if the finance minister sees stories of growth, if the finance minister sees sources of revenue, congestion charges, carbon prices, decent property taxes, and so on, then it seems to me that you have a case that can be made. But it turns on the positive side of investment, the positive side of cities that you can create, and the positive side of revenues. And that is the key to making those cases. Sometimes you have finance ministers that are gloomy and they say it's all impossible. And every now and again, you have those that are prepared to take a different view. But you have to found it on the examples of the challenges, sorry, on the descriptions of the challenges, but the examples of what you can do and how you do it. And it is possible.
Look, I really agree with the intention, huh, and what you are inviting and what can be done and all of that. But at the same time, look at our major cities, whether that is Berlin, which now has also fallen, whether that is London, New York, etc. You have the modest middle classes basically having to withdraw from the centers of the city because it's too expensive. And, you know, we really have a housing crisis, I would say, in most of our major cities. And when you look, and I mean, one image that sort of maybe helps is where before you may have had three families living, now you have one very high income. But we're not talking the 1%, we're talking the 30% that is very rich in our cities. This is creating many, many little crises, which are often invisible.
But in the end, what's being said, I think, is that perhaps trying to solve these fundamental problems at a municipal scale is insufficient. And I think that's probably, I mean, some of the issues you've been talking about are not resolvable.
That's right.
At the level of
the municipal government is not set up to do that. And that's a very important point.
Let's go for, there was a question, I think, over there. Can you stand up? Thank you.
Hello. I'm a first-year social policy student, and I would like to ask Professor Ricky about his statement on urbanization. You said that urbanization is a process that is iterative and incomplete. So could you explain, so there are five main processes that sociologists would have identified, and what do you think the next process will be? And for Professor Lord Stern, I would like to ask about the main conflicts that you identified for societies nowadays, which is political issues. What do you think is a good method to resolve it? Do you think to resolve like urban sprawl or climate issues, do you think it's better to use bottom-up or top-down or a mixture? Thank you.
Nick, why don't you answer that? And I'll think of an answer.
I don't think it's a horse race between top-down and bottom-up. I mean, what Philip Rode asked about convincing the finance authorities in the country as a whole is answered in large measure by showing what can be done with resources and how to raise resources lower down. And I don't think you can have, as it were, a top-down approach or a bottom-up approach. I mean, they work if they combine together. But one of the problems we've found with cities is that actually the bottom-up is suppressed in many ways by the overall systems of public finances and decision-making, which don't give them the freedom that they need to make decisions. Of course, what finance ministers worry about is if you give them the freedom to make decisions, they make the spending decisions, but they don't make the revenue decisions, and you end up in fiscal trouble. But I don't think that that's necessarily something that we can't deal with. We've learned a lot about how to deal with it. But if we just look at the problems and we just say it's all too difficult and it's all going down the tubes, well, what do you conclude from that? I conclude that you have to find ways of doing things better because we've done badly.
So the answer to your... I'm chair, I'm not allowed to have a view, apparently. So, but I think what I can say in response to your question is that using the phrase that cities are iterative and incomplete, if I hear what all of you have said, it's reinforcing that point in the sense that both in terms of who owns the city, it's changing all the time, it rather whose voice is represented there, Nick, in saying how does the infrastructure actually allow certain things to happen, or more importantly, stop good things from happening because you're locking them into old models is significant. What I was getting at by that is that on the whole, if we look at cities over the last 100 years at least, those that are doing relatively well are the ones that are able to adapt and change. Unfortunately, nearly all the professions involved in trying to fix our problems, and I put architects, urban planners, designers, transport planners, and many others at the top of that list, live in silos, in professional silos, which try to come up with a quick fix. That's behind what you're saying as well. You try and sell one piece of infrastructure to solve that problem with autonomous vehicles, cars, or whatever else. Adam Greenfield's essay in the book is exactly about the restrictions, the limitations, and the social impacts of, say, technology changes. So recognizing at the beginning that cities are something that you have to, like a human body, a metabolism, play with, fix, but not find one solution or that one size fits all is absolutely the heart of the agenda. And we mean that at a very physical level. Just look at these two aspects of Saskia's last slide. The bottom slide is actually at one level optimistic, despite the huge inequality represented there, because it can change. Yeah, right. The top one won't. We know that for sure until you demolish it. On that note, it's 8:02. I promised you could buy as many books as you wanted outside, so I think that's it. But before we thank our three speakers, I do want to thank a number of other people. Fiden, I've already mentioned, the publishers. The assistant editor with Philip and myself is Megan Roth, and Rosie Havner joined at the end, even though neither are here in the room. At LSE Cities, Alexandra Pekka-Moral and Peter Griffiths were fundamental in putting all the material together. It's beautifully designed by Atelier Works, the third in the series. And I want to thank Emily Cruz, all the stewards who made this evening happen. But please, can you thank the three speakers and everyone else involved? Thank you. Sorry about that.